It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Dogs were the first animal to be domesticated, but experts don't know exactly when that happened. They are keen, though, to understand dog evolution as much for what it tells us about human evolution as what it tells us about dogs. Gregor Larson is an archaeologist and geneticist at the University of Oxford who studies domestication. He recently co-authored a paper in Science about how dogs native to North America evolved over thousands of years, then went extinct after the arrival of Europeans. Gregor, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So the story we always hear about dogs is that a really, really long time ago, humans befriended wolves and then eventually domesticated and bred them to become pets. But that may not be true because we don't actually know how dogs became dogs, do we?
Not so much, no. There's a lot of ideas out there about what that process may have entailed, but we don't have a lot of hard evidence for how you get from a wolf to a dog.
So it could have happened by accident?
I think there's quite a few people in the community who are thinking that it is that most things are by accident and that dogs really aren't any different in that regard. Or more accurately, the idea that people intentionally domesticated dogs by simply grabbing a wolf and bringing it into a camp with the idea of one day having a cute little puppy with floppy ears who would play with your four-year-old is perhaps a bit more far-fetched.
So I'm interested in this idea that domestication doesn't have to be intentional. Talk to me about this.
It's more that it's emergent. It's more that you have two different species, and that could be dogs, it could be cats, it could be sheep or goat or any number of other things that are very familiar to us now. And that what happens is that both populations of humans and animals start to become start living in very closer proximity, and as a result of that, the selection pressures on each of them start to shift a little bit, and so that what you end up with is a domesticated animal, or one we would recognize today, but that entire process is not something that was driven intentionally by people who had a very goal-directed idea of what they were starting out to do and then achieved that by applying a particular set of selection pressures over a period of time.
So talk to me about what we do know. I mean, this origin story about humans befriending wolves and what have you, I'm assuming at some point, we do know that dogs evolved from the gray wolf. Do we? Let's make sure of that first.
No, that we do know. That's absolutely fine.
Okay.
So, yes, and it was, curiously, though, it's a population of gray wolves that we strongly suspect was in the Old World, so somewhere in Eurasia. It looks like there are certainly gray wolves in North America, but the dogs that came in with people to North America were derived from Old World wolves rather than from New World ones.
Okay.
And though there may have been some genetic contribution from, so what I mean by New World is North America,
right.
South America.
Right.
And by Old World, I mean Eurasia, generally. So, and very much like the people coming into the Americas, some of those people who came in brought dogs with them that were derived from wolves that were from Eurasia.
So we'll get to that in a moment. But the question here is, so we know that dogs derive from gray wolves and humans interacted with them, didn't necessarily say, sit, gray wolf, right? They didn't actually try to domesticate them in that way. But what are some of the theories about how humans and gray wolves interacted that brought them closer together?
So here's one potential theory or one hypothesis for how this may have happened. We know that for a lot of species, what they can, they form ways in which they start to interact with an environment that will shift them a little bit. And they form these things called ecomorphs, which basically means that if you are, for example, a killer whale, there are some populations of killer whales that really like sea mammals and other populations of killer whales that do very well but subsist on salmon instead.
Hmm.
So if you have a bit of a Capulet and Montague situation where it's the same species, they recognize each other, they pass each other, but they have very different ways of going about their daily business. And that becomes a culture, and that culture then gets embedded within the genes so that when they give birth to pups, those pups get reared on a very specific diet, and that's how they learn and they pass that knowledge along. So we know this is true in wolves as well. There are some wolves who follow caribou across Canada and other wolves that just stick around mostly in the forest and consume a lot of other things but are not migratory and they don't have to follow things very much. So you could imagine a situation where there was a population of wolves that at some point began following a group of people. as though people were large herbivores in this case, but therefore they would have an incentive to protect them while they could subsist off of all of the waste products that humans were generating as they were moved up and down the landscape. And so through that process, then you get a tightening of that relationship, and that also helps to separate that population of wolves off from the other ones, and that reduces the amount of gene flow that you would have from other populations, which might then sort of resist the kinds of selection that were taking place as that population of wolves and people started to become more acclimated to each other and live in closer proximity to one another. And from that point on, that might be the first step. And from that point on, then you talk about a little bit more deliberate selection pressures, and maybe you get a dog from there. But the important point is that that's a biological mechanism by which, and we see that in a lot of other animals and a lot of other species, a mechanism by which you can get differentiation of populations that would lead to a slightly different way of living that might then get embedded culturally and then might get embedded genetically. And so that's one possible mechanism that we've been exploring.
I want to go back to you said Capulets and Montague species. I love it when scientists quote Shakespeare to me, but is this something that you guys use to categorize?
It's something that we came up with a little while ago. It's just a way to sort of distinguish between two very close, I mean, it's the same species. Nobody's going to argue that Capulets and Montagues aren't, but there is such a big cultural division between the two that it actually limits gene flow between the two. And then we see this in the natural world as well. And it's not just in killer whales. We see it in foxes and in caribou and a range of other moose and a range of other taxa as well, where there is a cultural difference and a distinguishing between things. So they can reproduce, they just choose not to.
We are talking about the anthropology of dogs with archaeologist Gregor Larson of Oxford. What stories do you have about dogs in your life that shows how they connect with humans? 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Gregor, I want to get back to this how long does it take question. How long does it take to make this genetic transformation? And how long have dogs been domesticated?
Those are great questions, and ones that we're wrestling with. One thing that we know for sure is that what has happened over the last 200 years bears very little resemblance to the preceding 10 or 15,000 years. And simply because what the Victorians were very good at was classifying things and closing breeding lines and establishing the whole concept of now what we call a breed. The idea of a breed, in at least the Victorian sense, in the way that we now think of it, really didn't have any purchase or any real analog in the preceding 10,000 years of human-animal relationships. And so that entire idea of what a dog is, so when we think about what the origins of dogs are, we're often very, our perception is colored by our recent experience, which is born of just the last century or two. And as a result of that, I think that really limits our understanding of what dogs were and how they related with people over the preceding millennia. I mean, another example of that is we've got a huge archaeological data set that we're looking at. And when we look at the bones, we find it very we can distinguish dogs from wolves going back to about 1600 AD. So for the last 300, 400, 500 years. Prior to that, though, it becomes very, very difficult. And so the really... And for a lot of people, when there's a story of how the Irish greyhound or the Irish wolfhound went extinct because it was so good at eliminating wolves from the Irish countryside, well, at the time that was supposed to have taken place, a lot of archaeologists I know say that there were no wolves in the Irish countryside, and that this idea is that there were probably more a lot of feral dogs out there, but at the time nobody was really distinguishing that much between wolf and dog. And so because we now have a very strict definition of those two things, we tend to impose that upon the past and expect it to be there, and when it's not, we get very confused.
So talk to me about research done on dog remains in a site in Siberia where scientists postulated that some dogs may have been used to pull sleds, others eaten, others sacrificed for religious purposes.
Absolutely. And one thing that's very true about dogs that isn't so true of other animals is the degree to which they have integrated into human life. And dogs have been doing jobs for us for a ridiculously long time, and a variety of jobs that no other animal can even hope to achieve. I mean, you're not going to have cats smelling out bags in Kennedy Airport, or a domesticated goat telling you when you're next going to have an epileptic fit. You know, these kinds of things are not the kinds of things that other animals do. But so, and the really nice thing is that for the study that you're talking about, there is a site that's about 9,000 years old where they have all, it's very well preserved. It's in the high Arctic of Siberia, and they have very nicely preserved material culture and the actual sled runners and leather and all kinds of things. So yes, dogs were being used a very long time ago to pull sleds across the tundra landscape.
We have a question from Chris in Milwaukee. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. So, Professor, I have a question. Just from the other side, you know, we talk about us domesticating the wolf and or the ancestors and descendants. How about from the other perspective? What do you think? And this is obviously maybe a little tricky to answer. Do you think that the wolf accepted us as humans into their packs?
That's a great question, Chris.
Yeah, and you know, I completely agree. In fact, one of the things that we're doing is we're trying to upend this whole notion of what domestication is. It's one of these terms that everybody uses and throws around pretty casually and thinks that they have an intuitive idea of what it means. But when you drill down into it, it doesn't really, you know, every single person is going to have at least two definitions of it. And I think that this idea of us domesticating something has been so, is such a strong idea that we hold on to that when it gets countered, the opposite of that appears to be, oh, well, cats domesticated us or dogs domesticated us. And that's funny because it inverts the idea, but I think both of them are wrong. I think that nobody domesticated anybody. I think that what we're talking about is emergent relationships and emergent differences in behavior and the way that things look solely as a result of a shifting of the selection pressures associated with two species getting together. So it's got a lot more to do with symbiosis and those ideas within biology than it does to have with anybody directing this process, whether that's the animal or the human.
We are talking with Gregor Larson about the anthropology of dogs and how dogs have evolved to from gray wolves to be domesticated animals and lots of different species of domesticated animals. We're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're going to be back with more on dogs in a moment. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Oxford archaeologist and geneticist Gregor Larson thinks that the world would look a lot different if domestication of animals had never happened. And because the first animals to be domesticated were dogs, Larson is determined to find out how that happened. But the answers are few and far between. What do you think about what dogs know and don't know about humans? Do you think your dog reads your emotions? 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Gregor, I want to ask about dingoes. Dingoes are an Australian dog, and we had a listener write in to say that dingoes don't seem to want to be domesticated in the way that that other dogs have been domesticated. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, dingoes are interesting, and I think what they really nicely demonstrate is the fluidity of the relationship that dogs and people have had through time and how you can go in lots of different directions. So, you know, right now we have wolf populations and human populations. They don't really have that much to do with each other, and they kind of stay away from each other, and you've got dog populations and human populations where the dogs are, you know, like completely more at home with people than they are with other dogs. And they become sort of obligate human children in a way from both sides of that relationship. And we know from dingoes that there were no canids in Australia. They were brought there by people. And if you're bringing a canid with you, you're not really bringing a wild wolf with you. So the dingoes in Australia are clearly descended from dogs, which are descended from wolves. And then they get out, they go feral, and they start occupying a landscape which may have already been a bit denuded of quite a few of the very large-scale carnivores that were there. And then it was the population was able to then survive away from humans. And so a kind of reversion or feralization of that process, as we refer to it as sometimes. So they represent a really interesting case study of how you can go from, very simplistically wild to domestic and back again.
We talked at the beginning about you wrote an article in Science magazine about the extinction of dogs in native North America. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun because we just did not expect that at all. In fact, when we first started this study, we were focused exclusively on Eurasia because everybody at that point knew, of course, that dogs in North America, though they were there, that they were, everybody thought it was just a backwater, really, of East Asia, and that whatever was going to be there was going to be related to dogs that were already found in China or Eastern Siberia. And we started sequencing the genomes of a handful of them and then quite a few more of them. And we realized, much to our surprise, that all of the dogs that were in North America prior to the arrival of the Europeans were represented a completely distinct and unique lineage of dogs that didn't exist anywhere in the old world and certainly didn't exist anywhere else that we could find, despite the fact that there had been tens of thousands of dogs that had their genome sequenced. So then when we looked through that through time, we realized that at least 90 to 95% of that entire lineage has vanished after the arrival of Europeans. So following Columbus, a lot of Europeans arrive, they bring their Eurasian dogs with them, and they replace all the Native American dogs that have been there for the last 10,000 years. And how that happened and whether that was a factor of biology or disease or persecution or culture or some combination thereof, we're not entirely certain, but we cannot find any modern dog that really bears any relationship whatsoever to the dogs that were there just 500 years ago.
Wow, and the closest living match to their DNA isn't a dog, is it?
No, and that was even the crazier thing, is that there's a cancer called canine transmissible venereal tumor. It's the world's worst STD. Instead of kissing somebody and coming down with something that you can easily fix, you get a tumor, and it attaches to yourself. And so we can look at this tumor, and we can see an unbroken lineage going all the way back, because it's not that it develops within you. It's just passed on from dog, in this case, dog to dog. And when we looked at the original genome of that tumor, we found that its closest ancestors were, in fact, these pre-Columbian dogs in North America. So that even though the dogs themselves don't exist, they now sort of exist as a tumor that's found in dogs that are globally distributed.
So maybe that's what killed them, and then that's what lived on?
It seems unlikely. The cancer is not very... it doesn't kill the dogs. You can live with it for quite a long time. So, and because it's so closely related, we suspect that maybe the dogs in North America already had some resistance to it anyway, but maybe it was a different strain that came over. I mean, it's entirely possible. I mean, as I say, at this stage, we're really a bit baffled about how you can eliminate a population that size. Although having said that, what I find fascinating about this is that dogs are so close to people that wherever you go, if you find something that's true about the humans, that will also be true of the dogs. Right. And in this particular case, it's not just the ancestry, it's that the persecution of humans in North America when the Europeans came over was pretty complete as well. And so perhaps it's not a surprise that the dogs went the same way.
This is totally fascinating. We've got Gary from Boscobel on the phone. Welcome to the program, Gary.
Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask your guest if he has any insight on the idea of especially paleo, early paleo people, and interacting with wolves, not necessarily allowing them into camps, but enticing them to stay near camps with food scraps and bones and stuff. Those early paleo people were subject to a lot of big meat-eating predators, and to have a group of dogs near the camp as an early warning system or even a way of fighting off big predators would seem to me to have been a very valuable asset.
That's a great question, Gary. Thank you for that. Gregor?
Yeah, no, that sounds entirely plausible. And dogs have been serving as sentries for a very, very long time. And there are certainly dogs that play that role for modern pastoralists who protect flocks of sheep and do a very good job of it, and not just warding off other wolves, but lots of other stuff. And that kind of gets back to what I was saying before about the ecomorphs, that as soon as a wolf becomes incentivized to protect a resource, and if that resource is being able to subsist off of a human niche, then yeah, it will act as a sentry and protect that resource and even go so far as fighting off whatever might be trying to come for the people.
You have theorized that dogs were domesticated not once, but twice. Explain that to us.
Well, this is just a working hypothesis that we have, in that we have both archaeological evidence, which shows that the earliest dogs that we can find in Eurasia are on the very east side and on the very west side. And in the middle, there's plenty of people, but there's no dogs for a very, very long period of time. And then we look at the modern genomes combined with some ancient genomes that we've got. We again see this very deep split. So there are East Asian dogs and Western Eurasian dogs. And the split seems to be older than the first appearance that we can find in the archaeological record. So That seems to suggest to us that there were two separate lineages of wolves, both of which went independently through this process of domestication, and then later came together, and there's been a big mixing from there. So it seemed to fit the data at the time, and we've got a ton more data coming through the door right now that we're going to evaluate within the context of that hypothesis and test it and see how true it is. But for the time being, I don't think it's not out of the question.
So what would human history look like if dogs had never been domesticated?
Yeah, another really good question. I mean, I think if you eliminate domestication writ large, then certainly you don't have 8 billion people on the planet. You've got maybe a couple of 10 million or so, which is about what it was prior to 11 or 12,000 years ago. You certainly don't have anything. I mean, we are effectively mobile bands of hunter-gatherers subsisting on a landscape and, you know, doing it pretty well and pretty effectively. But there's no such thing as money or writing or economics or history or politics, at least on the kind of scale that we're used to. I mean, none of this stuff exists. And that only emerges as you get very large population sizes. And humans on the planet today are entirely dependent upon big populations of domestic plants and animals, when the irony is that most of us don't ever see the production of those things. We just know that they exist somewhere, usually in kids' storybooks, but we're very happy to subsist on them because without them, we wouldn't be here.
So Gary kind of had this right, that wolves protected humans and then humans then kind of protected the wolves.
I mean, although which order that comes in and who's responsible for what, I mean, again, I come back to this idea of emergence, that it's really both of those populations kind of doing a kind of romantic circling dance, and then everything comes out of that, but never as a directed process where somebody's saying, you know what, that wolf would be very good at warding off something because it's happened. There's got to be an incentive for the wolf to be doing that in the first place, and I don't know how you get a person to make that incentive.
Gregor Larson is an archaeologist and geneticist at the University of Oxford who studies domestication. He's been talking to us about the anthropology of dogs. Gregor, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
I'm Kerry Kaufman. You are listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
All dogs go to heaven.
I miss my dog.
Heaven.
I kiss my dog.
Heaven.
I miss my dog.
Heaven.
I kiss my dog. My dog had a name. Keep it his name alive. If I had to leave hell on earth,
all dogs come to heaven.
My dog had a name.
I'm gonna sing his name.
Keep it his name alive.
I'm the one to blame.
If I had to leave,
he would do the same.